Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we are broadcasting from the International Culinary Center. And I am particularly excited today because we have a Canadian chef, perhaps one of the greatest Canadian chefs ever. And you're going to hear his story in a moment. Jonathan Gushue is from the Berlin in Kitchener, Ontario. But more fondly for me, he's from Newfoundland. So anyone who knows all my Canadian leanings knows that anyone in the Maritimes is close to my heart. Let me tell you a little bit about Jonathan. He opened the Berlin just last December in 2015. But before that, he really made waves. He went to college, but then he really started his fine dining working at the Four Seasons, and he's worked all over the world, in Vancouver, in Tokyo, in London, and then named head chef at the Truffles restaurant in Toronto. But then he went on to Langdon House in Toronto, which became a Relais and Chateau in 2005 under his guidance. And they don't have Michelin stars in Canada, but that would be equivalent probably to about two Michelin stars. He was also, he made the world's greatest restaurant list, and he has really put himself and Canada on the map. And Jonathan, I am so excited to have you here today. Welcome to the International Culinary Center and Chef's Story.
Well, thank you very much, Dorothy, for having me. That's quite an intro.
Well, it's true, isn't it?
Thank you.
It's hard to get a little bio in just so quickly. So, as I said, you're a Newfie, and I don't know if a lot of our listeners out there know how beautiful Newfoundland is. You want to explain where your roots are from?
Yeah, no, it's a stunning place. If I had to describe it like anything, I didn't. There was no other way. Until I went to Scandinavia, I didn't have any other way to describe it. It's very, again, very rustic. Literally, St. John's, where I'm from, is only a 4.5-hour flight from London, or to London, so you kind of get the idea. It's most easternly point of North America. So it's I know everyone seems to think when I talk about it, they're like, oh, you know, I'm in the Arctic. It's not the case. It's, we get the Gulf Stream and the Labrador Current. So not, not very warm summers, but not very cold winters. A lot of fog. Rains a lot. So
sounds beautiful.
But it is, I think, as you can attest, I think more so it's the people that really are make it such a colorful place. Mm-hmm. A lot of character. It's pretty much 100% Irish. And, you know, they still, the Protestants and the Roman Catholics are still fighting.
Are they really? I didn't know that.
Well, they've gotten, you know, it's like anywhere. You need to fight about something.
That's true.
That seems to be the case. They still joke about, they still make fun of the Roman Catholics, still make fun of the Protestants and vice versa. It's really great. Growing up there is very different than it is now. Oil struck about 8-10 years ago. So it's strange. You know, I grew up in a place, you know, with, you know, a lot of, you know, Chevrolets and you know, now there's like Maseratis and Porsches and BMWs. And I mean, when I grew up there, I don't even think you could buy a German car in Newfoundland. Like, so it was a bit different, but still a lot of character. You know, we're
a lot of fish.
I mean, my father was a lawyer, you know, and based and went on to be Chief Justice in Newfoundland. But for the most part, yeah, the entire economic structure of Newfoundland was fishing, all exporting.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the unique foods they have in Newfoundland?
Oh yeah, I mean, you see a lot of it comes from again the people coming over to fish, and it seems to be a mix of kind of these peculiar dishes that people got lost in translation from, you know, the Portuguese and the French. They do a lot of gratins. They just don't quite do them like the French did them or do them. It's not, you know, a lot of, you know, cod cooked in heavy bechamel with a ton of cheddar cheese, which, you know, it's funny, you know, from a nostalgia point of view, you know, quite often I do find myself sort of, you know, looking back and there is a place for that. But I think some of the more famous dishes would be fish and brews or a jig's dinner. Now, jig's dinner would be a Newfoundland or a Newfie version of corned beef and cabbage.
Oh.
It's different. Like, we would have, that would be served with peas pudding, always served with a roast of some sort, which mm-hmm. was always a turkey. I don't know why they said roast, because it's always a turkey. And the equivalent of the jig's dinner would be, instead of corned beef, it would always be salt beef. And it would be salt beef riblets. Not sure where these came from, but these are the saltiest things you've ever had in your life. You soak them typically for 3 days, and when you actually cook the salt beef, you cook your vegetables in a bag in a muslin, and it's the vegetables are still too salty, and
wow.
it's unbelievable. Like they do, they always. I remember always my uncle. This is people get so serious about fish and jig's dinner. I mean, he used to say, I don't know why, but he would be very adamant about 12 hours, or no, every 6 hours he would have to change
the water.
And he would literally set his alarm for 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning to get up to change the water. So that's the type of sort of people you're dealing with. They're very, very steeped in tradition.
Tell us about the potatoes in Newfoundland.
Potatoes are very important, but they have to be, it's a floury potato. There are no, if you try and discuss any other potato, there is no other potato but a floury potato. And
what do you mean by a floury potato?
I guess at the close, even, it would be in Ontario or in Toronto, it would be something like a Klondike, which would probably appear in upstate New York, I imagine.
Is it Yukon?
No, that's still, that'd be far too waxy. I mean, when I grew up, those type of potatoes. If a potato was not white, stark white, it wouldn't be acknowledged. It's not a potato. So probably more like a russet. But it's still even more floury, and they would only eat them. And it's really interesting. They would only eat them riced. The only way you could eat them is you boil them to death, and then put them through a ricer and let them steam off. And then you would serve that with pan-fried cod, because that's the only way you serve cod. Skin off, and then you would serve it with salted pork fat, and that could be, and then just the general juices of the fish or the pork would flavor these floury potatoes.
Is there a fried bread in the morning?
It's called a tauten.
That's
it. Yeah, you see that again. That's I always I find all these things. I I want to find origins. I like, to me, it's interesting. You know, this is not, nothing in the New World has been invented. It all came from somewhere. I mean, I've only seen it. All it is fried dough, and but it has to be pan fried. Where you see, it's a donut. It's a pan fried donut, really. You see, the only time I ever saw it, I saw it in just outside of Buffalo in South Wales. They do the same thing, a pan-fried dough, but they dust it with cinnamon sugar. So this is, in Newfoundland, they covered it with
maple syrup.
Corn syrup, because we never had maple syrup. Was for rich people. You only had anything that really, the origins all came from whatever you could take. Sorry, it was not corn syrup, molasses.
Molasses.
It would have to be Crosby's molasses. So it'd be anything that you could stand a voyage from Newfoundland to Bristol, England. So anything that was sort of, you had about three or four indestructible items like saltfish, potatoes, and molasses.
So you grew up in a relatively well-to-do household if your father was a lawyer and chief justice. And what was your, did you eat local foods or did you have a different kind of
That's really funny. I had a very different type of diet. My father went to school in England, and after university got a job in Rome. So he said he describes landing in Italy. It was like watching black and white your entire life, and then finally getting a color television.
What a great analogy!
And he never really he was there for about 4 years and. Why he came back to Newfoundland, I don't know, because I think he hated it ever. He didn't hate Newfoundland, but I think what he just always, he would always, I shouldn't say that, he never criticized Newfoundland, but he would always go on and on about the food in Italy. Honestly, he spent a lot of time in the north. He even, his first wife was even from Rome. But I think that's what drove his, because of him, is how I started, got a love of food. And a fascination for it, and I think more so from him, the willingness to do whatever it takes to get the best product you can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we used to have these little adventures, and I don't even remember questioning it growing up. I would just, you know, in Saturdays we'd get in the car and we'd go somewhere, and it'd be nothing for him to drive 150, well, it would be the equivalent of about 90 miles for a bowl of pea soup, because in his mind this was the best pea soup. So
he had an appreciation for the local.
He had done well. Not many things. He loved soup.
Mm.
Now that being said, when he made soup on Saturday mornings, it was vichyssoise. That was the only soup he would make. He made it every Saturday morning, and you know, obviously in the winter, I guess it wasn't vichyssoise in the winter, because he would eat it hot. But he would make his own soup for the rest of the week, and he would eat soup and a sandwich every single day.
He brought to work because he liked his own food.
He loved his own food. And that was always, he used to go on and on about things. He would talk, every time he would, a slice of Vidalia onion, he would have to stop and give a 5-minute dissertation on the importance of the Vidalia onion.
So did you always want to be a chef?
No, never entered my mind. I didn't, because at that time, I think a lot of it came from, I mean, my father was an Oxford graduate, so it wasn't really, you know, cooking.
I can imagine.
Cooking was a hobby.
Siblings? You have siblings?
No.
Oh, no. So it's everything all, it, was on
it's
you.
All, it's all me. But he just wouldn't, he never, I mean, he said to me one day, he said, I'm so proud of you that you did something you loved and you're happy. And that was interesting, because he said as much as he, I don't think he enjoyed what he did. I think he did it because he was good at it, or it was expected. Mm-hmm. His father was very demanding, from what I gather. But I didn't consider cooking, because I didn't. I think I actually thought it was, I'm for lack of a better term, I guess I thought it was for people who couldn't do anything else, and I sort of shouldn't. And I remember it got to a point in my life where, I mean, even people would even say to me, you know, because I always worked in restaurants and hotels, but I'd always work in front of house. And I just remember having friends tell me, you know, why don't you get into cooking? And this is in the late 80s. And, you know, they're saying, why don't you cook? And I remember thinking, I remember thinking there was no way I could tell my father I'm going to become a cook.
Yeah.
So that was my own fault. Not looking back at the time.
So when did you decide, what did you want to be when you were growing up?
I didn't want to be anything. I didn't really know there. I didn't. I just sort of towed the line. You know, I woke up one day when I was 14. My dad said, "You've got a job at the Radisson downtown. Go see so and so, and you start tomorrow." And that was sort of it. And you know, I started in banquets. Just you know.
So, as a teenager, you started cooking, but just as a job.
No, I started in not cooking. I was a banquet porter.
Oh.
I was in like just moving tables around. You know, like I went. I did that for years, 2 or 3 years, working in with Radisson Hotels or mm-hmm. Radisson in St. John's. Then became a waiter in small restaurants in St. John's. Then took a hotel course at the College of the North Atlantic. Mm. That got kiboshed sort of halfway through, and mm. I was allowed to transfer my credits. It was a hotel management course, mm. And went on to do get in a hotel management a degree program with sort of / Georgian College in Ryerson in Toronto.
Ah.
And oh, I had big plans because at that point, you know, at this point I was sort of thinking, because I'm in this way, I found out through Ryerson I can get to Cornell, and boy, that'll make the old man happy. And so really, long story short, I mean, I one summer I got a job with as a sommelier's assistant at a Relais Chateau in northern Ontario, and a very big deal. Everyone, I mean, it was the premier hotel in the country, no question. It was the only Gold Shield. I mean, that's when they used to do Gold Shields, so that's how far back I'm going. It was the only Gold Shield in the entire country. Amazing wine cellar. Everyone was French. I mean, there was about 112 employees, and I think six were Canadian. They brought everyone over, which was basically...
Oh, French.
All French, yeah. They brought everyone over from France, which I realized after that's probably just... So none of them could... Because it was so in the middle of nowhere. It was so secluded. I think they wanted people they couldn't take off. Mm. Like, I think that... But that was the first time I'd ever really had amazing food. Really seen... Never had a Burgundy, didn't even know what it was. And, you know, cigars.
How old were you then?
I was 19. Through that, I guess the owners would often talk about, you know, for furthering, if you want to get into, good hotel management programs, you know, you need to get into the Four Seasons. You need to get into the Four Seasons Toronto. They have the power, it's head office for. The world.
You Canadians are so lucky if you're going to have one great company, Four Seasons.
Well, now Canada has both. Now has Fairmont. There's now, apparently Canada has 65% of all the world's luxury hotel rooms. I don't, like in under their, under their.
You are the real Swiss.
I don't know how, I don't know quite how it happened, but they did, it's funny seeing,
that's
now that they, Canadian Pacific became Fairmont.
I think we're going to have to take a break, and we're going to come right back and start talking about your professional career.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth-generation cheesemakers, combining old-world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company. The operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Well, Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today, my guest is Jonathan Gushue from Toronto, Canada, the Berlin in Kitchener, which we will get to in a few minutes. So, Jonathan, you started your sort of apprenticing in the Four Seasons, or what your journeyman?
Yeah, essentially, it turned out the only... I wrote about 12 letters to the food and beverage director and to anyone I could. I mean, I remember applying to Houston, behind everything, and I had more rejection letters than I could shake a stick at. Then one day I got a letter asking if I wanted to be the breakfast cook's assistant at their fly-in resort in Menaki, Ontario, Menaki Lodge. So this is a long time ago. This is probably 92. I guess, yeah, I was about 21. And so I figured, why not? You know, I could do that. And, you know, after, say, 6 months, I talked to some people, and they said, oh, sure, after 6 months, you can transfer out of the kitchen. And really from there, it was all, I remember, you know, because I'd been going to hotel management, so I got a bit of it. You know, we had some knife skills, and, you know, we knew how to tie a neckerchief and do all that stuff. And I had some fun with it, and I think I... kind of sort of thought I could cook. Anyway, I got in. Even my first day in the kitchen, I knew I loved it. I couldn't believe it. It was like sort of that aha moment. It was like maybe the way my father would describe going from black and white to color. Mm. I remember thinking I had no idea you could actually, like, work could be something you enjoyed. I didn't know that existed. I never thought that was possible. And I just had so, like, it was so much fun. It reminds me of reading Anthony Bourdain's book,
Kitchen Confidential.
Yeah, Kitchen Confidential. Whereas that there's that brief part where he talks about it. This, you know, he has that sort of eyes wide open sort of moment where, you know, all these, like, sort of swashbuckling guys wielding knives, and what I really like, what I got found fascinating was a lot of Germans, and they were all so neat, and everything was so well pressed, and everything was so pristine and perfect. And they all talked about, all they talked about was, oh, remember when we were in Vienna? Oh, remember when we were in Budapest? Oh, remember when we opened that in Beijing? I became enthralled with it. And I mean, I remember my first day. I had the most fun. And looking back, I was wrapping lettuce and cucumber strips. You know, I mean,
so you really did get the international bug. Through the Four Seasons.
No, 100%. Right,
yeah.
Away.
So I know you worked in Tokyo. What was that like?
That was awesome. Now, that wasn't Four Seasons. So that was, I worked in an, that was at an onsen resort. So a hot springs resort. So just outside of Tokyo. That was a really amazing experience. But again, very, I guess, humbling. It was a 1,600 room hotel. But it was all broken down. They had these, we were part of the Western kitchen, and then there was a Chinese kitchen, a Japanese kitchen, and a French kitchen, and they just brought people from all around the world. Money was no object. I mean, they had, I think, the Chinese kitchen had, I think, one or two Michelin stars, you know, and I mean, they would bring in, the entertainment was the conductor for the Moscow Philharmonic. Like, it just, money didn't mean anything. And I mean, we were paid very well. But when I arrived there, even though it was the Western kitchen, it was still very Japanese. I remember right away I was hired as a demi chef to party. And they within about 6 hours, they were like, okay, you know, you can't hold a knife even. Like, you're based, you know, and they're very direct. They're like, okay, you're an idiot. And what we're going to do now is you're going to stand over here. And you're going to peel these melon until we say you're ready to move on. In that time, too, to make matters worse, they really push a team atmosphere. So the fact that I was in, I didn't know how to use a knife in this kitchen meant that.
How long had you been a chef at this stage?
Probably about 5 years.
5 years,
yeah.
And were you? Angry when they said you can't?
Oh, my God, yes. Okay. Oh, I hated them. I don't know even... I'm so glad I stayed, but I don't know how I did or why I did. I think I just was sort of... I didn't want... Probably goes back. I didn't want my father to say you failed or you're a quitter.
So what did you, take me to the melon and tell me how it proceeded.
At the same time as the melon, then they proceeded to remove, they said, because it was garmanger where I started. So they said, okay, all the slicers and everything come out of garmanger. So now remember, this is, to put it in perspective, we would do dinner, garmanger would do dinner, would be a part of the dinner of this whole hotel. For we would do 700 people a night. So they said at this point, until you can learn how to slice like a slicer, as thin as a slicer would, we're removing all the slicers from the kitchen until you can slice. So the whole idea is, it's punishing me, punishing everyone. One fails, the team fails. So
oh my God.
So yes. Yeah, so eventually, that was slicing. And I just took it. We worked a lot. Like we would start at about 5:30 in the morning. And we would finish, you would be sharpening your knives about 8:30 at night, and then you had to big clean down. And then just after that, then they would let you. I remember, I don't know what got into me. I don't think I would have the energy now. I would just start slicing after work, just slicing anything. And they didn't mind. They said, if you want, you can slice melon till
you're blue. Did they give you a different knife?
Oh yes, right away. Yeah.
Did they say your knives are terrible?
Sheet.
Okay, I was going to say that. Yeah, the equivalent. Yeah. Japanese equivalent. Yes. What's shit in Japanese?
I don't even.
Sheet.
I don't even.
Thank God you don't know what it was.
I don't even remember.
You probably heard it all the time.
I don't remember. I can't believe I don't remember.
All right, so your knife skills, I take it, improved dramatically over there.
Mm-hmm. Well, they did. They were, once you took it all with a grain of salt and realized it's not personal, it's just a job, it's about getting it done right, which took me, I'll be honest, that took me 90 to 120 days at least, like to sort of stop, chewing my cheek off, but it was...
Well, when
was
the turning point when you stopped chewing your cheek off?
I think they realized I wasn't going to quit. And then I think we just have to, over time, we created a relationship. I think they, I think if you, it's like a lot of restaurants, there's so many restaurants, like you see in Michelin Star and everything like that. People go in, they only stay for 3 months to learn what they can. And like they say, that old saying is take the tricks and they leave. And I think, when they knew that I was going to commit to the year I promised I would do with them, that when they believed that was going to happen, then things changed. So it was about after 6 months.
How did it change?
They started giving me more responsibilities and, leaving me alone and then really started showing me things. And then just one day you come in and it's like, okay, you're doing fish now, now you're the demi chef de partie in garmanger. And then I moved up to chef de partie, and then even, they had me in, there was a Western restaurant that was just open for lunch, in the lobby, which was really cool. That did like this kind of quick 3-course menu, I was able to work with another chef that was, so they gave me a lot of support. And over time, I think it's just, hard work and perseverance.
So, unfortunately, this is only a 45-minute show. So, what other work experience did you have before you, opened your own or became the head chef that had an equal kind of impact on you? Because you were in London, you were in Canada, it's at some of the greatest restaurants.
Before I opened my own restaurant?
Yeah, yeah. What, do you have another kind of Japanese moment in your?
Oh, I think there are many. I mean, going to London or even England, period.
What was that like?
That was amazing. That was, again, I felt like I'd never eaten before. I went to London, a couple things.
What year is this?
This is 1994 I went to London. So great time to be in, England. I went to 94, I went to Bristol, England, and then 95... I went to London. I went to the Swallow Royal Hotel, which is, I think, now a Hilton, unfortunately. But I was quite fortunate to work under Michael Kitts, who was at the time the culinary captain for England. Very, very creative man. Like, I'd never seen anything like it. Like, he had a tureen of the day. But it wasn't... But he was one of those people who had the ability... He wrote us a menu that was for 6 months. So he had that mental capacity to predict... he had a different five-course menu written for 6 months, and we had full packages. I don't know how he did it. Looking back, I don't know how. I have no idea. But, I mean, that got me. I had no idea about terrines. I had no idea about pâtés and pâté en croûte and really doing charcuterie. And actually, I think what made me what there is that sort of they were – it wasn't easy. There was the demand in England. You know, there was a lot more positions than there were people. So I was really fortunate. How I got into a Garde Manger chef de partie in that hotel, I have no idea. Friend of a friend. Not a job I should have been in, but they were sort of, you know, I got a visa with them, and you know, I was really kind of over my head. The guy who I came in to kind of work with wasn't doing so well. So it was just presented. I was very fortunate. It was one of those moments that you're really right place, right time. So out of nowhere, I got, that's where I got the exposure to French cheeses. And what I did is the head of Garde Manger, I was able to buy all the cheeses. And I didn't even know it. I didn't know Bay and Ham. I didn't know, you know, Point Levesque, you know, Vacherin, you know. All these truffles. I mean, I'd never even seen a truffle. And then basically in this hotel, it become all of a sudden out of nowhere, it was my responsibility to buy this. And they're like, don't spend too much. And you're like, so I invariably, the first couple times I spent too much. And yeah. So I really got a bollocking, you know. So, but through that, you know, their eyes, when I started to appreciate, I'd never seen really good product before. Mm. As much as Japan, I was only able to scratch the surface in Japan because of my skill. And that's what they focused on. They focused on my skill. You know, they didn't bother with the product. Though, when I think about product in Japan, I had to laugh. I think I told you about that the first day I opened the freezer and it all said product of Canada or product of Newfoundland.
Yes.
anyway, I'll go back. But that was when, and I think when really I had that moment, I went to London and... you know, it was a very stressful environment. I worked at the Barclay, and then went on to work with Jean-Christophe Novelli at his restaurant Les Savoirs. And that's where I really things changed, because I didn't know. He was all about, you have to build a flavor library. You have to, and it was that thing like, did you taste it? It would never even occur to me to taste things I was making up to that point. But that was very big in England. Period. But it really became apparent working with Jean-Christophe Novelli, because I'd want to throw up at the end of the night. I mean, you were eating everything. It was constant. Every time you went in the restaurant, all you could smell was duck fat and truffles. But the food was beautiful. I mean, he was really, you know, his ability for flavor and putting things together, and still to this day, I use his recipes. And, you know, I he's one of those people that just, you know, I don't know how he does it. Just this inherent ability to, you know, create amazing food.
So we're going to take another little break here. And when we come back, I want to jump to when you started being the chef. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton. Today, my guest is Jonathan Gushu from Toronto, Canada. His restaurant, The Berlin, is about 45 minutes west of Toronto and is a true farm-to-table experience where he cooks over a hearth and has a very signature way of cooking. But we'll get there eventually. But now I want to know about your first, when you finally decided to take the helm and felt you were ready. Where was that, and what kind of restaurant?
That was at Truffles in Toronto. So that was when I went.
That's a Four Seasons.
Yeah, and I went. So I went back to Four Seasons after many years, and I was in I was a sous chef Tourneau in Vancouver, and basically told me. They told me SARS hit, and they said, you know, you got to go.
The SARS, the virus.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that was a big deal.
That was a worldwide, yeah, because it was Asian.
Yeah. So, and, you know, with all the Vancouver Asian tourism is huge. So they were speculating they were losing about $250,000 a week in tourism. So everyone vacated from the hospitality industry. Everyone sort of kind of amscrayed out of Vancouver. So they said... you know, take this job at Truffles or leave. And sort of, I was, you know, I knew of Truffles was a very, very well-known restaurant. I knew it was still one of the only five diamond restaurants in the country. At the time, the diamond, those, the CAA would be the equivalent of AAA, were really, the, it was the only rating Canada had at the time. So I was, you know, I jumped at the chance and, you know, a very, very demanding position. Really, I think it's where the sort of the stress, I wouldn't say that the stress began, is it's sort of that, that internal, as you know, they say stress is only what you put on yourself. So I think it's a matter of, that's when it started, of learning, of pressure, you know, that, that personal pressure of having to succeed. And also what got, I remember the first time seeing my name in print, like in a newspaper article, or seeing, you know, I remember too seeing my menu on the Four Seasons website. And it did, it, you felt something with that. And it was almost, I can't think of anything else, but it was like taking a pill or doing a shot of bourbon or something like that. In the way that you felt something. You're like, oh my God, you know, and because to that point I just hadn't thought of it, you know. But it was, again, maintaining those diamonds and stuff was...
five diamonds. You had the five diamond award.
So it had been the... at the time, I think, I was one of the youngest five diamond... I was 31 or...
Wow.
And I was one of the youngest to have five diamonds in the company.
Mm-hmm.
And there's... It's always different. If I was in Chicago or Los Angeles, it'd be a bit different. But Four Seasons, that's where head office is in Toronto. And, you know, it's very, that restaurant at the time was sort of, they considered it kind of a flagship.
Mm-hmm.
And again, looking back, it's you sort of look at it and you go, I don't know what I was, I put all that pressure on myself. And mm-hmm. I don't know, looking back, I have to sort of laugh because I don't know how, because, you know, in my head, they were, as I say, all of them were putting all this pressure on me.
Mm-hmm.
But a great experience in upholding standards.
So how long were you at Truffles?
3 years.
3 years. And then you went to Langdon Hall?
Then I got a call one day that a good friend of mine who was I'd worked with at the Barclay in London, he was the chef of Langdon Hall and he was moving on, and he said, "Do you want the job?" And you know, it was I had remembered when I was at the Relais Chateau I spoke of before, the Inn at Manitou, Langdon Hall was this new Relais Chateau coming on, or this new hotel trying to get Relais Chateau, so. You know, I wasn't sure. I went out, and once I saw the property, I fell in love with it. I mean, we had a one-acre garden. It was on, I think at the time, I think it was 93 acres. It was just a stunning property for everything, for foraging, for... and at the time, they really weren't... I saw a lot of potential. I mean, the owner, Bill Bennett, or one of the... the managing partner, Bill Bennett, he was very into... the land, you mm-hmm. know, it really, really had a great understanding of the property.
Mm.
I think they had, at that point they'd owned it about 16 or 17 years. So it was really, I looked, you know, it was sort of, it scared me to death, but I think it was, it was one of those opportunities.
How long were you there?
7 years.
And you kept the five-star diamond. What did you bring?
We were very fortunate. So I had my predecessor, Frank Dodd, just got five diamonds. So when I arrived, they hadn't even had five diamonds for a year. So we made five. We maintained five diamonds. So I started in 2005. So we maintained five diamonds the whole time I was there, and I'm sure that they still have five diamonds. I'm quite sure. We have in 2008. I think we got the Grand Chef Award from Relais Chateau, which
wow.
that's a big deal. I mean, that is like to get it, because that's being awarded by. Well, it's essentially awarded by the Michelin inspectors in New York City. So they you know, which are all, you know, the same people who do London. And so that was really
and
a big
you just
deal.
Didn't have Michelin stars in Canada. Otherwise,
no.
You would have had them. But
it's hard to say. I would like to think we'd have them.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be nice.
What does that do to your head when you get the Grand Chef Award? Was it affecting your ego?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
How so?
Oh, my God. Remember, I was told that...
Because you're one of the most humble, accessible chefs I've come across. And I think you've probably gone through a lot. We know you've gone through some. And so what does that do to a young chef at 31, 35, and you're getting these big accolades? What was your head going through?
I think that... your I guess your head can get pretty firmly lodged in your ass, you know. You really lose perspective. I think that the biggest thing, if I had to nail it, and the thing is too, I remember too when I got the letter from San Pellegrino in 2010. I remember I almost, you know, just kind of like, oh, sweet Jesus, but knowing that, oh, you know, a part of me was like, oh, God, this is it, you know. This restaurant, 80-seat restaurant is really going to get noticed. And then, but a part of me knew that, you know, your gut, I guess, is like, oh, shit. You know, this is, you need to prepare. You can't just roll with this. Like, you know, you need to prepare for it. I didn't really prepare for it as I should. You know,
What should you have done?
I think respecting the recognition that something like San Pellegrino can do, yeah, I think you need to take a step back. You need to work with your staff. You need to certainly stay at home in your kitchen and prepare and make sure you're ready for. Because the second that at the time it was, you know, Restaurant Magazine, the second that comes out, you're full. And it's not like any award you'll ever win before. It's not like, I mean, we won Grand Chef and we made every newspaper in the country. We got a lot of attention. But San Pellegrino or
the greatest
Restaurant
chefs.
Magazine.
Yeah, the greatest chefs. The greatest restaurants in the world.
Yeah, we were full from the very second that magazine came out. And it was just not ready. It was just like your head was spinning. Service wasn't ready. Kitchen wasn't ready for the kind of numbers, like doing 140 a night at you know, that level. Because we ran a 5-course tasting and a six, say, like a 6-6-6 menu, I think cheeses, I think we had, you know, for the most, usually had somewhere between 20 and 28 cheeses from, you know, Canada, France, Europe.
So you said stay in your kitchen. Did you start traveling a lot and doing a lot of press?
Or? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I did. I thought it was. You know what? Looking back again, I knew it was wrong and something I shouldn't have been doing, but I couldn't. I couldn't buckle down. I got to a point where I don't really want to say. I just wasn't dealing with the pressure. I wasn't dealing with the pressure that I was putting on myself properly. You know, knowing that all that pressure that you get is only, it's all self-driven. It's all self-motivated. I know that now. At the time, I'd feel all this pressure. So, you know, as I'm sure you've heard, I mean, I started self-medicating, I found a lot of the press dinners and things like that. I mean, in New York and in Toronto and things like that, I found it. I was very uncomfortable. I didn't feel, for some reason, inside I felt like I didn't belong in these circles. And to make myself comfortable, I mean, I would drink. And then it got, you know.
So you didn't drink heavily before that?
Oh, yeah.
You drank socially?
No, I was always a bad drinker. Like, I didn't.
So you just started drinking a lot more?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's hard to explain because I knew I sort of had that point in my life where, you know, when I was younger, I was a bad drunk, like, you know, or a blackout drunk. And then it was always that, okay, I'm not a bad drunk. Newfoundland's a bad place to be because everyone drinks too much. Mm. As I moved on, you know, and everywhere I went, so I had that sort of geographical cure. Mm-hmm. I thought the problem went away, but what happened was, as I was, you know, with college and stuff like that, with co-ops, I was going to different places, and I was just drinking like a lunatic, but it didn't really come to a head because I didn't never hung around long enough. When I went to Vancouver with Four Seasons, I stopped drinking altogether. It all became very, all those jobs were very, demanding jobs, and I just knew I couldn't do it. And when I got back in Toronto, the chef of this restaurant constantly, it's like every picture you see of a chef has a glass of wine in his hand. And I was, with Truffles and the Five Diamonds, beautiful wine cellar. Sommeliers from Loire, all these things, pairings. And it just sort of gradually started. And then I think what happened was is that we're at, the biggest thing was at Langdon Hall, I became the guy. I was like the guy. So, and I reached that point where I felt in the confines of that hotel, at least, and pretty much anywhere, I felt I could do whatever I wanted. So if I wanted, I would do, looking back, I would do absurd things, like just walk out and into, this to the service bar and just take a bottle of wine and walk back, just take it. I didn't, and I don't know, just because I could, it was just, I was.
And the
I was,
pressure.
Yeah, I was full of arrogance, but I think ultimately it was, I didn't know what else to do. Like, I didn't know, I couldn't just hang tight and, because I always remember, I used to love, there was like the rush of service and everything was so exciting. And then I remember the second service was over, it was like, as they'd say in Newfoundland, like the arse fell out of her. Like, I would have this feeling in my gut, like, now what? Where's the rush? Where's the excitement? Or you would always, or if something went bad, it was all those stories, as if you had a bad service, it was like, well, if you had a service like that, you'd drink too. I would drink whether I was happy, whether I was had a great service, a bad service, whether I had compliments, or whether it all went, in the toilet. Like, I just.
So when did it all hit? I mean, when did you fall off the cliff?
It all hit the fan. I had a rather... a couple of times. Well, I went to rehab in 2011.
How long had you been at Langdon Hall at that stage?
6 years, I think. No. Yes, 6 years.
And how long had you had the world's greatest restaurant ranking?
1 year. I did. It sort of, just after that, it started, like, I was drinking a lot just before that. Like, even, just drinking. Just, and there was no off switch when it came to drinking. I went to rehab in 2011, and looking back, I did it to pacify everyone else, that didn't work so well. So for a year I, lived the life, which was awful, which lived this sort of, I'm fine, not drinking. So drinking on the sly. So
were you working at that time at Langdon Hall still? Okay.
But sort of just... It's weird because you can't, where before I was a daily drinker, like even at this point, I could sustain anything as long as I didn't, as long as I knew in 3 months I'm going to go somewhere where I can drink my face off for 5 days.
Right.
What happened, it really hit the fan and I got a DUI in 2011, got another one in 2012. So when I got the second one, that was it. Like, that was the whole, in my world, in that, how would you put it? Your mind plays, so you can drink, you would do just about anything. Like, you would say anything, you will be anyone. I remember it, like, I used to just even, the silliest thing is you used to, I remember instead of just like a normal person who would say, I'm not going to drink because I have to drive. Like, I remember thinking that, okay, I know what I'll do. So I can keep drinking, and what I'll do is I'll keep a knife in my pocket. And if I get caught by the police, I'll just slit my throat. And like, that was sort of this thinking that, and that's alcoholic thinking. It's absolute madness. And I laugh at it now.
What got you through? I could be here for 3 hours listening to this, but when people have that disease, what finally got you through it? How did you?
I did when I figured, okay, well, I had the DUI, the second DUI. There's no way I'd convince myself that. I mean, I'd had a lifelong of feeling, less than or whatever. And you know what? I've got a whole life to explore why I felt, less than or whatever. It's not a blame game, but I took off in 2012 and thinking, okay, what I'll do is I'm just going to take off because, my family's not going to accept me anymore. I've really done it this time, blah, 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 blah. But really all I'm looking for is any excuse to just drink for Because I've finally basically lost my marbles, because I'm being a dry drunk, you know, which is slowly ticking away. I'm not doing anything about it. I'm doing nothing with my spirituality, nothing, as you know. I'm doing nothing to contribute to the human race. You know, I'm just being this sort of, I'm just sucking. You know, I'm just sucking whatever I can out of life and not giving anything back. So I took off. And I just drank and drank and drank and drank and drank and drank. And then the most horrifying thing is that when the alcohol stops working, like it stops taking away the pain.
Yeah.
And then I just remember, and I don't know how, it was like a revelation that, oh my God, you, and it wasn't about that, oh, you're about to kill yourself or anything like that. It was like, you've left your whole family. You've left 3 children and a wife with nothing. Absolutely nothing. And I just... And even it's not like I had a solution at that point. I would have stayed there, in turmoil, because I didn't know what to. I didn't know what to do. I just didn't know what to do. But I know, a friend came and got me. They found me. I was recognized in Montreal, and then, thank God.
You were just down and out.
Yeah, I was just sort of. Yeah, no, I mean, I was down now to a point, you know, I was just living in hotel rooms. I was going from hotel to hotel to hotel. Totally. I mean, you can't even imagine the level of paranoia. I mean, I swear I was like, I it would have been like watching a spy movie or something. I was so...
You were trying not to be found.
Yeah, I was so paranoid. I mean, looking back, you can see like, you know, that's all the stuff I did. How bizarre. Like,
so you were ready to be found.
Probably. I don't know what I was. I just, the only thing is that, you know, there's a saying, you know, everyone has their own bottom, or, you know, sometimes you have to hit rock bottom or whatever. I was so fortunate that I didn't go that far. Like the next step would have been, I guess, the streets. And I know lots of people who have gone that far and who have eaten out of dumpsters and have, you know, had to do those things, sell themselves for a meal or a bottle or whatever, you know? So I'm very, very fortunate to have, and I don't know what happened. I remember sitting in the hotel room, and my friend looked at me, and he's a very spiritual man, and sort of looked at me, and he said, "Are you done?" And for some reason, I said, "Yeah, I'm done," and that was pretty much, that was kind of it.
Is it a struggle today to stay sober?
Not at all. Not at all. No, I wouldn't. I couldn't. No, I don't. Don't get me wrong. I can't. You know, I don't like sitting around drunk people.
Yes.
It kind of gives me a migraine. But I think it's funny, even, you know, New York was one of those places I used to come and hide to drink. And it's funny walking down here today. Like, I was, oh, my God, I haven't been in this part since then. No, it's not a struggle at all. Not to drink. I mean, I can see alcohol, everything doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me having a restaurant or anything like that. And even at the restaurant now, I mean, that's why, you know, in the beginning it was sort of a joke. I was like, why do you keep bringing that for me to taste? That's why I have sommeliers, you know. And then, you know, people get it. After a while, you know, they just...
So let's go to a beautiful part of your life, the Berlin.
Yes.
You know, I've not been there. You know, we only met last week, actually, in Korea, and I was so taken with Jonathan. You know, I'm so happy you're here today to do the show. The passion this man has—it just exudes itself through the. It's almost a primal passion, you know. And you cook with a hearth and coals, but you also are very much about the land. You left Toronto proper to be in the farmland and to work with chefs. Why don't you tell us about the Berlin and what the inspiration is there?
I think a lot of it was I was, again, cooking in Toronto and then thinking that I was really doing it kind of the way they did it in London or the way we did it in Japan. And then you get to Langdon, where I'm out in the country a bit, but still a big hotel. It's still, you know, 53 rooms and, you know, so still... So there I thought I was really doing it. And then it was amazing to actually, you know, decide, you know what, I'm really going to, you know, I just had, again, an aha moment. Maybe it was sobriety. I don't know. But it was, you know, I didn't want to be, it occurred to me that this is a bit of, you know, this is a bit of bullshit. Like, you know, you're, I start kind of smoke and mirrors, whatever. You know, I don't like people saying, you know, oh my God, he's, you know, there's such a farm to table guy when I wasn't really doing it 100%. So that's what I set out to do. The first thing I noticed when I went out to Kitchener and that region, the Waterloo region, was, you know, there's so many people, so many purveyors. I mean, I think there's 4,500 farms in that region, registered farms. So there's a certain amount of money. You need to register, I think, $20,000 or $50,000 in income, or you have to make $20,000 or $50,000 in income even before you have to register. So there's even more people out there, a lot of hobby farmers just doing stunning, like, guinea hen, pigeon, you know, the most amazing non-taste carrot, the most, you know, outrageous mushrooms, you know, and just people there's a big, huge European heritage there, and I think there is a culture of food in the home and product, and everyone seems to be so connected. Almost every, I'd say one in four people or one in five seem to have a story about a farm or, you know, their connection to it. Product is very important to them. Now, restaurants have never really been that important to them in that area. But there's certainly, what's nice is that it's such a knowledgeable group of people when it comes to product. Like, they know, they may not, but they do get how you're cooking it. And I think it was a bit of both. I think, you know.
What drew you to the hearth, to be the heart of your restaurant?
I think a couple things. I think cooking, everything is cyclical in life, I think. But I think ultimately I remember one day turning around and, you know, in the kitchen sort of, you know, calling away orders or, and, you know, and just having one of those moments and looking and seeing, on the saucier station, there's, you know, five thermocirculators holding my meat, holding my, you know, here's my beef and here's my pheasant, and I just, you know, it seemed so, whether it is or it isn't, I'm not poking it. For me, it felt like I was being disingenuous, like it wasn't as real as I wanted it to be, and I wanted something that was, you know, I think it was in also too in Japan, we did a lot of that. You do a lot of, like, it was nothing. It was quite often we were cooking over coals, very different, not like a hearth. But doing a lot of things over coals. And so it's just a mixture of that because, I guess, to be more honest, I think that was sort of the way I've tried to, you know, go about my entire life now is just to be honest. You know, not at the expense of someone else or anything like that, but just to be honest. And to me, that was an honest method of cooking.
One of the most honest things I read about you is we have a lot of farm to table, you know, a lot of people want to do farm to table, but it's really table to farm because the chef puts in an order to the farm and says, this is what I want from my menu. But from what I've read, you take what the farmers bring you and then you work with it. And sometimes they'll bring you a hell of a lot of fowl and you've got to figure out what to do with it. Or maybe it's not quite what you wanted that day. And you have to be very flexible and pivot and be able to work on it. Just a minute. We'll take a break here. So we were talking about the farmers coming in and you just working with their product, as opposed to, I'm sure you asked them for product, but there was that story of whether they brought you 1,500 hens or something like that.
Yeah, they brought me all my, yeah, it was, there was a great deal of duck. yeah, and I think that's, I want to use what people, like what these ladies or gentlemen or producers, what they're passionate about. That's what I don't want, you know, to get into, you know, well, what do you have? Because what I found, if I say, what do you have? And then it sort of goes to, well, why'd you grow it? What do you like about it? Well, how do you prepare it? What do you do? What is, if they give me what they enjoy growing, it's going to probably be a better product. it's or be their best product. And I do it a lot of, you know, more so with we do with as many people as we can, but mainly people raising fowl and you know the people doing herbs and you know some you know I wouldn't call them foragers because they're purposely cultivating wild herbs on their properties and vegetables and things like that I say there's one farmer, a Soiled Reputation in Stratford. He's a genius. I mean, and I say, you know, you bring me whatever you want. On Thursdays, you bring me whatever you want. And, I mean, sometimes I think the cooks hate me because it's okay, you know, because I keep at them. I remind them, like, remember, it's 3 o'clock. He's still not here. So make sure in your head you remember, like, we've got that vacant, there's that vacant hole for tonight of, you know, at least we know. So as the time goes on, they know that, okay, well, obviously if it's 3 o'clock, it's not here yet. It's going to be raw. You know, it's going to be, and I want them to think, you know, for themselves and then prepare. How are you going to do it? How have we done it before? How can we make it different? What is it? Think about the timing. Typically, what does Anthony bring? You know, it's not like he could bring anything. I mean, it's, you know, you're talking about a scope of 3 or 4 things. So it's about, you know, stepping back, calmly looking at the moment and seeing, you know, how you're going to put those things together.
That's truly working with the farmer, not mm-hmm. saying you have to be here. He's not a distributor. It's a farmer. You know, we're running out of time. I hate to say that. We've actually gone over time. But what I'd like to do is invite myself up to the Berlin and maybe go around and visit some of the farms with you.
Anytime.
And the produce and just see what the magic that you're working. Do you want to tell us exactly how we get to the Berlin? Because I'm sure we have listeners out there.
The Berlin is very, very simple if you're driving or flying. I mean, west of Toronto by the 401. And then you just take, I think
it's only 40 minutes from Toronto?
It's only 45 minutes from downtown Toronto, mm-hmm. barring traffic.
I hear that the prices are really reasonable.
Yeah, we do. We try to keep our tasting menus. We do a 4-course for $55. And on the right night.
Canadian dollars, folks.
Canadian dollars. That's right. So perfect time for it. Yeah. Well, we were just written up in the New York Post.
Fantastic.
Where to go with your money for your, uh-huh. your tourism dollar.
Okay.
And and then we have a 5-course, or sorry, a 5, 5, and 5 menu.
Right.
That ranges between about $11 and $38.
Okay. On that, I just even hate to end this talking session, but it's really been a pleasure to have you here today. I'm so happy. I just met Jonathan last week, but I feel like I have a lifelong friend. And just know that you always have a home here at ICC. And thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor.
All right. And I just want to do a shout out to Robin Cohen, my producer, and to Heritage Radio, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.